Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And while it's always a joy to delve into Southern, especially New Orleans, cooking, and that's what we're going to do with this program, starting out with one of our most favorite chefs, John Besh's new book called From the Heart. The title of John Besh's latest book is Cooking from the Heart, which I think is pretty appropriate because he's a chef, if you don't mind my saying so, John, that everybody seems to love. You're very lovable.
I really appreciate that. I haven't heard that before, and I don't feel loved very often.
Oh, you should.
Oh, I'm joking.
Anyhow, but this is the third major book that you've written in sort of a series. Tell us what the difference is. You had My New Orleans, My Family Table, and now Cooking from the Heart. What is the difference from book to book?
Well, first of all, My New Orleans is really like a love story about growing up in and around the outskirts of the city and just loving, you know, just really it's a book about New Orleans, the most culturally significant food city in the country, whereas we're the only indigenous food left in an urban area. And so it's really playing on that. Written right at the time we almost lost the city to Katrina.
Oh, yeah.
My Family Table is all about our prescription for, you know, my wife and I cooking at home. Quick, simple, easy meals that make it possible.
You have four sons, and I'm afraid I hesitate to ask how old they are now.
Well, let's just put it this way. The oldest is going to Boston College this weekend.
That's what I was afraid of. What happened all those years?
Scary. And so, Cooking from the Heart, these are, I'd like to say, you know, just life lessons and tasty anecdotes and delicious recipes based on those years of formation, trying to learn to become a chef. I had great mentors that gave me so much. And that's, in turn, what I wouldn't be where I am today without those mentors. So it's really written in homage to them and to all the great teachers out there that pass on this incredible craft from one generation to the next. I had long wanted to write this book and just really never had a place for it because I am John from New Orleans, and people will always consider, they hear my name and they'll think New Orleans or Southern, and they're not thinking about the other side of the equation, which was the apprenticeship in Germany and then later in Provence and working at the Chateau de Monco and these different places that gave me the sensibilities that I was able to really impart into my New Orleans cooking. So much of what we cook down here in New Orleans stems from those very places that I cooked and that I trained. And coming back to Louisiana, back to my hometown, and then in applying all these great lessons, I think is the only reason that I'm a significant chef today.
Well, I certainly loved your stories about Carl Joseph.
He was just he is such a great guy and such a jolly gentleman.
Yeah,
one of the first chefs that I worked for that was a very successful father, as well as the famed Michelin-starred chef from his region of Baden-Württemberg, but also just a great teacher that could take time giving up himself, even to a poor kid from New Orleans that somehow ended up in his kitchen.
You had some hilarious mistakes in that kitchen, however.
And that's another thing that I want to do is really share my blunders with everybody, because I feel like, you know, that's how I've learned all my great food lessons, through a blunder, and it's through this constant, that maybe not conscious humiliation, but understanding that, you know, this is a process and you have to learn and you have to be humble and you have to be patient. And every time I thought that I really knew something, well, come to find out I didn't. And I'd make a drastic mistake. And I love to show those because too oftentimes great food and old cuisine has been cloaked in mystique and has been cloaked in a sort of snobbery. And I wanted to break all that down and just show how human it all is and how attainable it is through things like my cooking lessons that I have in most every chapter.
Yes, and you even do a step-by-step photograph illustration of techniques, which is...
Well, that's the way that a lot of us cooks really learn. I think if you ask most chefs, you show a few pictures of a dish, or you let them smell a dish for that matter, and a chef, competent chef, will make a valid attempt at recreating that dish. And so having a pictorial at the same time as a little background on that dish enables the cook to then have something to go by step by step by step. Too often you and I might have cooked a recipe and then we're thinking like, I must have missed something because mine does not look like this.
Uh-huh.
And it's just, if you have these little steps thrown in, then you can change some ingredients around and you understand the process so much better.
Now you have photographs, vintage, I don't want to use that term because it makes it sound too old, but old. When you were first there, you photographs you and Jennifer and the chefs and so forth. And then, if I understand it correctly, you retraced your experiences back to these original mentors. And that's where we got the more recent photos. Did you actually
go
back?
That was a lot of fun. Taking our Maura McAvoy and Dorothy Kalins and all of us and Jennifer and Dorothy's husband. And we just packed up and rented a van and stopped and spent time. We spent a number of days at the Spielweg in Germany and then drove down to Provence. And you know the journey, and it's just fabulous and full of such inspiration. So what I wanted to do is shoot everything on location where you have, there's an authenticity to it that is hard to replicate. And it's certainly not something that there's always going to be those that say, well, can't find that ingredient here or there. But understanding the soul of it or the heart behind the food allows you to cook with that same amount of passion and heart. And so if you can't get a particular mushroom, well, fine, let's substitute with another one. But this is what inspires me.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, this picture of you, are you smoking a cigar or what?
That was back in the cigar days. That's when I thought I was a big shot somewhere, probably outside Weinstube-Henriette in Moulouse, France.
Now, you know, I've always loved your La Provençal, La Provence story about your restaurant and your words to the dying owner, chef, proprietor. Tell us the story about La Provence.
La Provence is a place, beautiful little, like, auberge. It was an auberge at one time. Now it's just a restaurant, but it was a restaurant just down the street, or not street, down the road from where I grew up in the Bayou Lacombe area of the North Shore. And it was owned and run by just a darling but fiery little Frenchman named Constantin Caragiorgio, Greek name, Frenchman from the port area around Marseille. In particular, the little village outside of the Marseille port is called Port Saint-Louis, St. Louis, right there on the mouth of the Rhone River. Anyway, long story short, I went to go work for him after I had already traveled a lot and I cooked and I had a couple of Michelin star restaurants under my belt and I'm thinking I'm really something else. And he says, no, you're not. You know some things. You know enough to get you in trouble. Now, every summer, I want you to go cook with my cousin, and I want you to go cook with my cousin's aunt, and I want you to cook in these little mom-and-pop places, these small brasseries and bistros, learning how to cook like the Provençal grandmother. He says, then, my friend, then you know what a bouillabaisse is. Then you'll understand what aioli is and all these different dishes. And now I find myself thinking the same way with these young chefs. And I had a young chef the other day and says, this time we're going to do I want to create this dish and I want to serve it in a garlic aioli. You know, garlic aioli over the top. And I said, an aioli? What the heck is an aioli? And to say garlic aioli is like saying a garlic sauce. To make sense. And so I'm now like turning into the chef Chris that I used to know. Yeah. Long story short, I later was able to purchase his restaurant, La Provence, from him when he was on his deathbed. And I wanted to keep his persona, his beautiful restaurant, alive. And it really hasn't ever been doing better than what it's doing now.
Oh, good, because we ate there. We loved it when we ate there.
you know, it's a trip out into the country, and there's something about that that's really soul warming. And there's something about the food of that region of France, and it's easy to make that, you know, talked about making the obvious correlation between the food of the southern France and the food of Louisiana. It is so easy. You know, it's a, both of them are rice-based right. cuisine. Both of them have, we have inherited that style and that joie de vivre. And so I love what we're doing out there. And this book is really all about that. It's all about what I've learned and what I've passed on to my cooks and what, frankly, what now these cooks are going into the city, opening their own restaurants and passing it on to their cooks. And so it's interesting how important that mentorship is.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it's also really important never to forget that we didn't create this great cuisine. It's been passed on to us.
You loved Alana So.
Alana So is just a fabulous friend of mine in the fashionable small village of Saint-Rémy-de-Provence. Alain had made his apprenticeship with Chappelle with Alain Ducasse. He had worked for Roger Verger. He had worked for Paul Bocuse. He had worked for the brothers Poigrot and Rouen. And this is a man that had never seen a kitchen that wasn't three Michelin stars. He sells, he leaves all that behind to open up a small six, maybe eight table restaurant where he is the cook. He has one apprentice that helps him wash dishes, and they also do their best to serve the guests at the same time. And so he kept a very small menu, and he would always have a table d'hote of the day and a rotating prefix menu where no matter when you went in, you would begin the meal by a soup de poisson. And so we retrace those steps. And Alain just taught me just how to care, how to really put love and heart into that soup, how to take your time, how to speed it up at times, how to use just a little, like, dry fennel stalk to make all the difference in the world. And so it's just about using the entire fish. It's not just respecting the flavors and the textures, but it's about putting these great ingredients together like that Provençal grandmother. And so I just love the way that he cooked and the way that he approached food. And there was such sincerity and honesty that I learned from him at a time when I came from coming up in America. Great food meant that you had to import it from somewhere else around the world. Great food meant that it had to have foie gras on top and truffle oil drizzled over the top of that. And what Alain taught me was just simplicity, and the use of just simple ingredients with great technique is all that you need. And you can be very proud of the country cuisine that he cooked, or for that matter, that really gave me the idea that I want to go back home. I want to go back home and really apply these to each and every little crawfish, to each and every little shrimp, and to the little soft-shell crabs that I have, and to all these other great ingredients that I've known my whole life, but in some ways I've just kind of taken for granted.
I'm always interested in your take on whether New Orleans is really back. It's been, how many years, 8 years now?
It's been over 8 years since Hurricane Katrina.
And
I would say New Orleans is on a better path now than it ever has been in my lifetime.
Oh, that's great.
There's a consciousness that we have that I've never seen, where people are politically involved, civically involved. People are in these neighborhoods that had been written off for years. Now you have all sorts of great little urban farming projects taking place. It's known as, you know, it's the startup capital of America right now, with young entrepreneurs coming here, finding the freedom in New Orleans and to work, you know, in order to create small companies and startup businesses. And so I see so much passion applied here by the New Orleanians of old, plus a very young and progressive crowd that has made New Orleans their home because they felt like they could then make a difference in the world. And I'm seeing it take place and shape, and it really is exciting.
Now, Anne had another question.
Well, I just wanted, we've been talking about the stories in the book, but I wanted to mention that the recipes in the book are absolutely scrumptious. Can we assume that the Black Forest cake is the definitive Black Forest cake recipe and the bouillabaisse? What about this bouillabaisse? It's absolutely fabulous.
Well, a couple of different bouillabaisses, and what we have, here's the problem with something like the bouillabaisse.
Okay, getting
the bouillabaisse is absolutely, you know, this is a dish that is steeped, and you really need the fish of those rocks.
Right.
The poisson de roche that you have along the rocky shorelines of that part of the Mediterranean, where then you're cooking the entire fish, heads, guts, scales, eyes, and that adds beautiful flavor, this richness that is really hard to achieve. And so what I've tried to do, and I've created a great recipe where what I've done is I've got the standard recipe, and then I have a recipe where if you don't have access to that, then let's use three big fish heads and some crabs. And I've tried to approach it by not watering it down and saying, well, if you can't, that none of this matters. It matters. You really need those fish heads and that gelatinous quality that they add to the broth when it cooks. And so I have two different recipes based on whatever you have access to. Almost everybody can find some lobster shells or some crab shells or shrimp shells for that matter, and we can always find fish heads. And so I have a great recipe that really works. The Black Forest cake that's Carl Joseph's definitive Black Forest cake that's served every day at 4 o'clock on the terrace of the Spielberg. And at that time, in that place, in that area of Germany, this is when they celebrate, you know, they have Café mit Kuchen. And so and it would be the German equivalent to the tea, having tea for the British. Wow. They have coffee and cake.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't want to have scones and clotted cream anyway. it's just not a New Orleans thing. I mean, you put the clotted cream in something else.
I would say that, I mean, if people are interested in really the kind of recipes that you need to have a Mediterranean repertoire, your mussels are, I don't know how many recipes for mussels you've gotten here, but a lot, and also artichokes, I mean, the things that we all need. I think probably nobody's going to make the wild boar's head.
The wild boar head.
Yeah.
Right.
Although I worked with a chef who was very proud with figuring out about the blowtorch. I mean, it was a cookbook I was writing. But anyhow, I should mention that you have now 9 restaurants in New Orleans. Well, also not just New Orleans, but 9 restaurants total. And I think we've eaten at most of them. Let's see. August, Besh Steak, Luke. We've not been to the one in San Antonio, La Provence, which we talked about. I've not been to American Sector yet, or the Soda Shop.
We did go to that.
Did we do
it's in the World War II Museum. We went there.
Oh, that's right, we did that.
Next door to the American Sector, we also have, in that same building, the Stage Door Canteen, and then we also have the what we call the Soda Shop,
right,
which is down just a block within that same campus of the National War II Museum.
And then
we have Born in Dominica.
And I'd say Dominica is like, it's finally getting some recognition, but we are madly in love with Dominica and with your chef there. So,
he's fabulous.
Oh, he is. I hope he gets some awards this year. He's been getting some, I guess. Anyhow, just for anybody heading in your direction, go to those restaurants. You love every one of them as we do. And also get this book, which is so beautifully written and photographed, John. I don't know where you go for your next book, because this one's sort of a culmination of a lot of things in your life.
Well, thank you so much. I'm glad that you enjoyed it, and it just thrills me to no end, because these stories and recipes are so personal that it thrills me to know that both you and Peter enjoy.
Well, the world should be happy that you are willing to share them. And John, it's always a pleasure. We could talk to you all day, but we know you have to go off and do something else. Maybe whip up a batch of mussels or something like that. and we have to go about some more business too. So thank you so much for joining us on the menu today.
Love talking to you as usual, John. Bye bye.
Thank you. Y'all take care.
it never ceases to amaze me what a combination of a really great guy and what a wonderful chef John Besh is. It's always a pleasure to welcome him to the program. And we'll have another Southern Star coming right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Back again with another Southern Chef star hero in my book, John Currens.
And let's make things very clear here, because all of you smart people know that John Currens' restaurants are all in Oxford, Mississippi, which is near Memphis, not near New Orleans. But it's proof, I think, the success of his empire is proof that of the old saying, you can take the boy out of New Orleans, but you can't take New Orleans. You can't take New Orleans out of the
person,
boy.
Yeah.
And while he's refined his cuisine from how he started off, he's still very much a true son of the South, and quite a character too, as you'll find out.
Here's a book worth buying just for the Duke's Mayo recipe. Hi, John Currens.
Hello, dear. How are you?
Okay. This book is such a delight. It's called Pickles, Pigs, and Whiskey. And to give people the idea of the tone of the book, it's subtitled Recipes from My Three Favorite Food Groups, and then some.
and according to Mrs. Currens, John's mother, it's a dirty book.
I've been accused of having a terribly foul mouth at times.
It's 50 Shades of Grey in the kitchen.
Well,
with drinks.
They told me to channel my voice, and unfortunately that voice leans towards profanity from time to time. So
I can't imagine why that would happen to anybody who spends time in the kitchen.
maybe why I was relegated to the kitchen.
But, John, this book does channel your voice, and it's persona, it's your philosophy of food, it's the spirit of the South, particularly both, I would say, Oxford, Mississippi, where your restaurants are, City Grocery being the flagship, I would guess, and also where you grew up, one of my favorite cities in the world, New Orleans, Louisiana. You have some of that vibe in here too, don't you?
Yeah, I don't think that I'll ever escape or ever want to escape being a New Orleans boy at heart. I think it is arguably, one of the most special places on the entire planet. If you look at the map of the United States, it's very arguably one of the most culturally and historically significant cities, and that's breathed in every pore of the city, whether it's in the asphalt and the roads, the music, the buildings, the food. And drink it, but like me, there are some greater purists in the world that would accuse New Orleans of just being a little bit vulgar on its own. So,
On Bourbon Street, on any given day, that's true, and especially at Mardi Gras.
Well, of course, but we like to think that Bourbon Street is an anomaly, and if you were able to sort of just erase that from the map, the rest of New Orleans really stands on its own. And
a really sad thing happened in my family. My brother and his wife, they take cruises, and they go all over the world, and for some reason they were in San Francisco, and they went to the wrong part of town, and when they were in New Orleans, their land-based tour took them to Bourbon Street. I don't know why he doesn't ask me where you should really go.
That's truly unfortunate. And I think what's sadder than anything else, there are people who unfortunately end up in New Orleans and don't have anybody to give them advice or point them in the right direction, and they do end up sort of getting channeled to Bourbon Street, and they go away from their experience with that being pretty much all that they see. They don't see the homes on St. Charles Avenue and the history and the architecture, and get to the clubs where good local music is playing, or get to the right festivals. And so, but that's probably true of a lot of tourist destination cities. They all have those sort of tourist trap areas. And it's,
but we should really be talking about food and drink, shouldn't we?
We could talk about this book, if I could get
right,
you
exactly.
Two off this your little subject.
Well, we just
talk about the book. I was looking at this one picture, and I had to read through the book to find out what it was, because there was no caption on it. And it's French fried pig's ears. I'm trying to think, is that calamari?
Actually, French fried
pickled pig's ears.
Pickled pig's ears.
To be precise. Yeah. And that's a beautiful picture and, you know, an absolutely wonderful dish. That's one of the things that on the book tour, guys, who I should say that on the tour, I'm touring from sort of restaurant to restaurant in different cities, and mostly my friends are putting on these book events. And,
oh, that's wonderful.
And just about one in every two stop, they've picked pickles. Fried pickled pig ears to serve as one of the past items.
Now, is your book tour on your website?
I don't think that it is, unfortunately, but I could be wrong. I haven't looked at it lately.
Well, what I want to say is that the thing that I love most about this book, and the fact that it's very savvy and humorous, but also about real flavor. You have this authenticity to what you say about stuff, and you say things that I've thought for a long time that most people, chefs particularly, don't come out and say about doing things. You're very determined with your way of doing it. One of your chapters actually is called My Manifesto, How I Cook. And what do you say there?
Well, it's odd. Without the book itself being a plea for people to start cooking again, and the irony is that I am sort of begging people to start cooking at home again and use this book. And the irony is that I charge people an enormous amount of money to come eat the same food that I prepare in the restaurants. And so it really is sort of begging folks to find the joy in cooking again. It has become in the last 30 or 40 years this sort of looming chore to go into the kitchen and just even turn the stove on. And one, we're losing connection with family cooking. We're losing that opportunity to share with friends. We're not feeding our kids well. A significant portion of the issue is just slamming pizza and chicken fingers into the microwave oven and shoveling down our kids' throats. And that the cooking, it shouldn't be looked to as a chore. And, you know, and I know people are very quick to point the finger at me and go, well, that's because that's what you do for a living. I loved to cook before I started cooking professionally.
Yeah,
I mean,
you've been at this a long time. And you grew up, as I said, in New Orleans. But you had grandparents in North Carolina with a farm. And you spent a lot of time with them. And you learned about preserving and... Let's just look down at, you don't do like soups, apps, mains, sides, and desserts. You do the categories which I think register priorities in your mind. Like your first chapter is stirring, shaking, and muddling, and in that you have drinks.
Correct.
You think that a drink is really important to the meal.
I do. The drinks chapter in the book, you know, really sort of came as a result of the fact that we chose to name the book Pickles, Pigs, and Whiskey.
Uh-huh.
I do a whole lot with cocktails personally. We have a great, great, great program.
Another one of your restaurants.
I just, you know, one of the first things that it says in the manifesto is, you know, turn on some music and make a drink.
This music. I mean, I should add now, since you brought it up, that with every single recipe, you have a piece of music that goes with it. And well, you have your own. How did you do that?
Well, I mean, if we look at the book as a, you know, more as a broad stroke look at it, all the things that you've mentioned are things that I wanted to do in order to make, you know, a unique offering on the bookshelf. See, a lot of books are broken up, chapter structure, you know, sort of by course or by, you know, by the protein or, you know, you see occasionally a sort of seasonal chapter break in books. And
yeah, right.
I just wanted to do something that was entirely different and that was unique and would be compelling. And so,
and it's,
you know,
to be read. I mean, it's not just a reference for recipes. This is good reading. You write very well.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I have a good time doing it, and so it makes that part of it a little bit easier. But so the chapter structure was one. Pairing music with, you know, with the food was kind of a little bit of a middle finger to the sort of what I find pretentious are wine pairings in cookbooks, because it's just, you know, nobody's going to go out and curate 130 bottles of wine in order to make each recipe in a book, or, you know, or saddle themselves with finding a 1968 Aubryon to go with some sort of tornadoes of beef. And so and music I just love. And I thought, well, why don't, you know, so many of these dishes that we do, you know, take me to very specific times in my life. I'll just pair songs with it. Gives folks a little submit to, you know, getting the playlist off of Spotify and listening to it while they're cooking. You know, they get to take a, you know, a little greater walk around in the little pea brain area of my mind to.
You have some unusual music selections, I have to say.
They are. No, I'm the only person in the world that likes every song on there. And I think I warned folks early in the book. It's like, you're not going to like every song on here. It's, you know, so feel free to fast forward.
Now, is the idea that you play while you're making it, or do you play while you're eating it, or is it both?
Either or. We've always had music in our kitchens in Oxford. Music is calming at a time when it needs to be calming. Like, we listen to NPR in the mornings, and then when dinner service hits, it, you know, turns to Guns N' Roses and Metallica and, you know, sort of louder, heavier stuff.
I was wondering, I mean, these days, is NPR soothing in the morning? I'm not sure. I would have thought the opposite might be true, and you might have to reach for a drink if you listen to it a lot.
Well, I think it's more soothing than Fox News would be.
There you go. Okay. All right.
So, but anyhow, moving on, you have the stirring, shaking, and muddling, and then you do boiling and simmering, and then really a beautiful chapter is on pickling and canning. I mean, I've been getting a lot of books with that in it, but yours is very special. I don't know what makes it so special, except you really sound like you know what you're doing.
I think, one, it's the love of that process of pickling and preserving, and where that carries me to in my life with my grandparents. But also, it's a very deliberate attempt to make folks understand that pickling is not about assembling all these hulking, boiling, roiling pots on the stove and sterilizing jars and lids. I mean, actually just make pickles in about 5 minutes and throw them in the refrigerator, and they'll keep for pretty much all eternity. So they don't have to be in sterilized jars and put up on the, I mean, it doesn't have to be a process that's taxing. It's really one of the easiest things that you can do.
Yes,
cut up some vegetables and make a vinegar brine and throw it over the top of them and put them away.
Watching my mother and grandmother can, that got me off of this whole idea of canning. The most I ever do is preserve lemons. I love this rosemary pickled lamb heart you have.
Well, and I'm glad that you picked that out, because that was the first recipe to go into that chapter, and that came from pretty much from an experience down in Miami that I had with one of my best friends, Wright Thompson, who's one of the senior long-form writers for ESPN, and we were down there for the Super Bowl a few years ago, and or the Saints game, as we call it. And we went to this Ecuadorian restaurant where pickled chicken was there. Their specialty. The place was called Super Pollo, so chicken, and it was really bizarre. And so we, of course, ordered the pickled chicken, and they brought out this plate of just anemic, gelatinous, cold chicken legs, and it looked absolutely awful. And I ate it, and it was okay, but my mind immediately went to, okay, holy crap, I know what I can do when I get home. We're going to start pickling meat like crazy. And so I started with duck legs. My favorite lamb in the world comes from Craig Rogers at Border Springs in the western tip of Virginia.
We met him not so long ago.
Yeah, where were we?
We met him in South Carolina, Euphoria.
He's such a wonderful guy, and raised
such wonderful food. He was the guy we met who did the whole lamb. He did the 90-pound lamb.
No, that was a big difference.
Craig Roberts from Border Springs Farm.
Oh, was it?
That's who you're talking about, right?
Yes, sir. But anyway, Craig's lamb is delicious, and he's very proud of it. And so I was always the guy behind the scenes going, you know, tell me what you've got extra of that you can't move, and I'll buy them. And so that's how I ended up with hundreds and hundreds of pounds of lamb hearts and lamb testicles. And so we started. He couldn't give hearts away a few years ago and started sending them to me. And said, just throw them on the grill with a little bit of salt and pepper and olive oil, and it's like the best sirloin that you've ever tasted. And so we started cooking his lamb hearts, and they do eat like
I can't get them. I mean, I had a lamb supplier local that had nobody. He couldn't give away livers and any of that stuff. And then he got a processing plant on his property, and the FDA makes it so difficult.
USDA.
The USDA makes it so difficult to harvest and sell those things. So I can't get any, and it kills me.
Well, call Craig. Craig will get
well,
you some
lamb. Well, we know
lamb.
Him. I mean, I have a picture. It's not on our website yet of me with him and his lamb. Right?
Yeah, I'll have to put that up. Then I can send him a note saying, John Carnes said, in return for this, you'll send me 500 pounds of lamb hearts.
Yeah.
So that was really... you know, when it came to the pickle chapter, you know, I wanted to put some very unique recipes in there. You know, I thought, one, I wanted to get the sort of the average home cook more interested in pickling, but I also wanted to provide a little something that might be of interest to professionals, things that you don't typically see pickled, like those roasted pickled shiitakes, the lamb.
Oh, arms. That looked good, too. That looked fabulous.
Yeah.
I like the okra and green onion hush puppies, too.
That's another story altogether.
Why?
Well, the hush puppies have a very special place with me. I was invited by Danny Meyer and the guys at Union Square Hospitality to come up about 7 or 8 years ago to cook hush puppies at the Big Apple Barbecue.
Oh, I love that barbecue.
It's magnificent. But yeah. I didn't realize what I was getting myself into, and when I was assembling my order to send off to him about a month before, and I was ordering cornmeal and flour by the ton, I realized that I was in over my head. And, you know, when I usually make a gallon or 2 gallons of hush puppy batter, we assembled 25 small bathtubs full of hush puppy batter. And it was truly dawning.
My.
And a magnificently miserable 2 days of standing over some fryers on Madison Square Park and cooking those hush puppies. And so I swore that I'd never cook another hush puppy again in my life after it was all over. And that lasted all of about 4 weeks.
You can't miss those. How about this country-style pork pate with chestnuts, which also looks divine?
You'll notice as you read through the book that it's really, you know, you could argue it's as much a sort of a high school yearbook as it is, you know, a cookbook, because so many of my friends appear in it that I, you know, cite as influences, inspiration, or what have you. And that pate, which is absolutely delicious, is really all about those chestnuts. And a dear friend of mine here in Oxford that has several hundred acres with hundreds of chestnut trees that he planted 25 years ago. And so in the fall, I'll go out with he and his wife on a golf cart and a couple bottles of wine, and we'll go get our gloves on and go picking up chestnuts and then harvest them from their those spiny, evil things that they live in. And
yeah, I love those. Yeah.
And then bring them to the restaurants where my prep cooks absolutely despise me in the fall because they'll show up with 2 or 3 5-gallon pickle buckets full of chestnuts and tell them to, you know, get to splitting and roasting. And
they don't split when they fall on the ground, I guess.
They do if you drive over them, I guess. we were in a small town in Italy when the chestnuts were falling off the trees. And they were everywhere, but
everyone was out picking them.
But there were all these old ladies out with their buckets, a bucket in each hand, picking up chestnuts off the ground.
I love them, and they work just so well.
With the
pork, in that pate, it's such an unctuous flavor and texture that it adds, and I just have fun playing with them. They make just an unbelievable puree that pairs absolutely perfectly with pork or beef.
Oh yeah. You've done some great things for some really wonderful products and processes. Number one, you rescue the reputation of lard, which I have to be a very big fan of. Secondly, you explain that deep frying can be okay, right?
Correct.
And, of course, you do wonders for using the whole pig, which everybody's been doing that now, but you really do use the whole pig.
Well,
in every conceivable way. The one thing I didn't understand is how you brine everything in Coca-Cola.
Well, not everything. That fried chicken recipe is in Coca-Cola, and that to me, that we developed that recipe around factory farmed chicken because it really is, to be perfectly honest, it's just disgusting. And it
sure
doesn't
is.
Have any flavor. It needs all
right.
the help in the world, and it's and that's why it's amazing to me to give folks a side by side taste of free range and well raised chicken versus factory chicken. It's they don't even compare.
So what do you put on? You put on the good chicken. You put Pepsi Cola. Now you probably sneaked some Van Winkle in there.
Is that what you're hugging, that picture of you hugging a barrel?
Oh, God, that was one of the most wonderful days of my life. That was a barrel that got access to for our 20th anniversary,
uh-huh.
To celebrate the 20th anniversary of City Grocery. And I was very happy to be there in Frankfort, Kentucky with it that day. So
well,
they're special people. They really are.
Yeah, Julian's a really, he's a super guy. He's so laid back, it's unbelievable. But I guess he can't get any more product for another 8 years.
I think he's finally come through the worst of it. There was a couple of years ago where I really worried, because for a year straight, every time I saw him, he looked so forlorn, and I knew that it was just because he was exhausted from answering the phone and having to explain to people why there wasn't enough.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Tell them no, and he was just the gatekeeper to this thing that everybody wanted, but only
a few people could get, yes.
A fraction of a percent could get access to.
Well, the recipes themselves are as individualized as you are as a personality, and even you do beignets, but you do them in pork fat with bourbon caramel, which I just swoon reading your cookbook, John Currents, and I wish I could think of when I'd ever be in Oxford, Mississippi. I don't even know where it is.
You mean how do I know where it is?
No, how do I know where it is? Where is it?
Oxford is actually about an hour south of Memphis.
I see.
South and slightly east. It's where the University of Mississippi is.
Okay.
And a delightful little town. I mean, and I've been here for 22 years, and I mean so much so that you notice the dedication is actually.
Yeah, I read. You feel that you're a native son, really.
Yeah, and as grateful as I am to Oxford for everything else they've done to me, being there to provide an answer to whether I dedicated the book to my wife or my mother, which was an unbelievably sort of challenging sort of thought to try to process.
Right.
they became the very easy answer,
I would say. And you're raising your little daughter, who's how old now?
She's just turned 8 months.
And she's
goodness.
She's dipping her finger in hot sauce or something, isn't she?
Well, no, not yet. Technically, we started making food for her about two and a half months ago, and so we're sort of sticking to all organic vegetables right now.
Good.
She loves more than anything in the mornings for me to feed her the foam off the top of my cappuccino,
that's cute.
which is just one of the cutest things in the world. And then now absolutely loves for me to feed her crushed ice like a mama bird feeding a baby bird. So I just chew up ice and put it in her mouth, and she loves it.
She loves daddy.
Yeah.
That might have something to do with it, I guess.
It is untainted ice.
The easiest way to get some of this luxurious food on your table is to buy a copy of the book, which is called, again, sweetheart?
Yes, it's called Pickles, Pigs, and Whiskey.
And make a detour sometime into Oxford, Mississippi. And the place to go is not called City Grill, it's called City Grocery.
And we don't have
time for an explanation of why. You'll just have to figure it out for yourself.
Yeah, and John Currents is called on the cover, the Oxford, Mississippi's original Big Bad Chef.
So Big Bad Chef, off you go. And
thank you so much for this wonderful book, John.
Yeah, thank you, guys. I always love seeing you and talking.
And we'll have another view on the New Orleans dining scene right after the break. So don't go away.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Next up is my newest best friend, Poppy Tucker, who we've decided we have so much to say to each other that we're probably going to start hanging together. There's nobody that gets closer to the New Orleans and Louisiana eat scene than Poppy, who interviews people, she cooks, she writes about it, she broadcasts about it, and she's taking time now to chat with us about her new book.
Well, she finally decided to put it all in a book as well, called Louisiana Eats, which is the name of her radio program.
But here she is with On the Menu Radio, and we were delighted she was able to join us. And she has a lot of very interesting things to say. Very much an insider about what's been going on in New Orleans for years, but especially in the recent years since Katrina and the wonderful recovery that the city of New Orleans and its region have made. So I'm sure you'll find this very interesting. And here's Poppy.
Poppy Toker, you look like so much fun. I'm going to have to personally come and hang with you.
Oh, please do. Let's cook together, Anne.
Right. Now, you've won all kinds of awards. You are a native daughter of New Orleans, and you've won all kinds of awards for all of the help you've given to recovering from Katrina, to preserving the foodways of your area. I like particularly that you beat Bobby Flay and your throw down with Bobby Flay. Your seafood
gumbo. Yes, that was
gumbo.
A very interesting experience. But you know, and you know what I like even better than the throw down with Bobby Flay, because somehow my name has become extremely synonymous with gumbo. And we had Super Bowl in New Orleans this year, and I had the extreme good fortune of cooking with Wynton Marsalis, making gumbo in my home kitchen for a segment that he did on CBS Sunday Morning. And he took one bite of the gumbo, looked into the camera, rolled his eyes, and said, "Have mercy, Poppy." So what used to be the Bobby Flay butt-kicking gumbo recipe has changed to the Have Mercy, Poppy gumbo recipe.
I can picture you guys with the lady from Upper Line.
Oh, yes, Joanne Clevenger.
And I would not get a word in edgeways.
Louisiana Eats is the name of this book, subtitled The People, the Food, and Their Stories. And boy, what great material you have to work with.
Well, thank you. It is an unfair advantage living in Louisiana, living in New Orleans. It is an unfair advantage. And the name of the book is actually derived from the radio show that I have been doing down here for about 3 years, also by the same name, Louisiana Eats. And from the earliest time of doing the radio show, I was struck by, exactly as you are doing right now, aside from doing fun, entertaining radio, I had this incredible advantage of basically creating oral histories from very important voices in our food system in various ways, whether they be farmers or fishermen or chefs or, you know, food producers in some way. And I saved all of the rough edits. And so one day I said to myself, you know, there's a book there. And so that's what the book is all about.
It's brilliant to do that. I mean, you did write that that's what you did, and I thought it was a brilliant move.
You think you have a lot of food-related unedited material. Just think how much we have going back to 2004.
Oh, my gosh.
No,
I don't know how you wade through that, but anyway.
Not very often is the answer. Fortunately, it's been put online a little bit at a time.
Well, I want to get in here, besides the book itself, that you have been named a hero of the storm by the Times-Picayune, your paper.
Yes.
So you were a hero of the New South and Southern Living. I mean, it goes on and on and on like that. You also interweave, which is something that I was very pleased with, your connections with slow food.
Yes.
And also with the edible schoolyard, both of those being very close to my heart as well.
Oh, yes, indeed. The fact that I've just been doing the show for 3 years, I've been doing this food thing forever and a day, and I love the food of New Orleans and Louisiana like a lot of people love their mother.
Yeah.
And so when we had that terrible weather event here in 2005 that really screwed things up, there were so many things that became endangered. There were so many things that felt very trepidatious in our world, and consequently, my work with slow food just dovetailed nicely in helping us restore and bring back all of those important things. And, of course, I had begun the first slow food chapter in New Orleans in 1999, when at that time we were one of the first 10 chapters in the United States. And the reason I began the chapter, one of my big motivations, was a project that they do that is called
the
Ark of Taste.
Yes.
And when I first learned about Carlo Petrini's concept, the Ark of Taste, I said to myself, oh my goodness, this is exactly what I have been doing for the past decade or more with my cooking classes, with my public speaking, and now I discover there's actually an international organization out there ready to help me preserve these vital and endangered foodways. And a lot of that made it into the book. I mean, one of my favorite chapters, Big Boys Do Cry, about how the Times-Picayune restaurant critic and food writer Brett Anderson worked so closely with me to really help revive the tradition of our treasured food, Creole cream cheese.
Now, this cream cheese is famous in our house because we knew nothing about it until, who was it, decided to revive it?
Was somebody in South Carolina, wasn't it?
No.
Oh, no,
Creole cream cheese is from New Orleans. Well,
John Full started producing it.
Except, you know what? You better read that chapter harder, because John Full didn't jump on that bandwagon until after Slow Food New Orleans, fuss about it, put Creole cream cheese on the Slow Food Ark of Taste, helped revive it by teaching people how to make it at home in their own home kitchens, because it's actually very easy to make at home. And then it caught the attention through the Crescent City Farmers Market and a slow food event that we hosted at a market one day. It caught the attention of an old dairy man.
Oh,
named,
really? That's
yeah,
right.
Named Henry Mauthe, M-A-U-T-H-E. And at that time, in 99, August of 99, I believe, there was only one place left in New Orleans where you could buy Creole cream cheese, and that was Dorgnack's grocery store out in one of the suburbs. And Henry, they were about to lose their dairy farm, this family farm that had gone on from generations. These people were dairy folks originally from Alsace-Lorraine before they began dairying in Louisiana.
Wow.
And when Henry saw how New Orleans responded to Creole cream cheese, he went back to the farm that afternoon and he said to his son Kenny, I've seen the future of the family dairy farm, and it is Creole cream cheese. So the Mauthes, the small family dairy, the Mauthes were the first to make Creole cream cheese again commercially. And it wasn't until a couple of years after, when John saw how successful they were with it, that John Fulf jumped on that bandwagon.
Oh, yeah. I didn't say he was the first. I just said I never heard of this cheese until he started, and we were just amazed that we didn't know about the tradition. So I guess we missed out the first wave of publicity coming from you.
Well, we didn't.
Well, you know, nobody knows. Pretty much, even today, unless you visit New Orleans, or you're real involved with the Slow Food U.S. Ark of Taste, or you grew up here, people don't know about Creole cream cheese. It's something that is so local and has remained pretty much very local that most people don't really know about it.
Well, now, this is the kind of thing that makes your book unique, because you've got stories of you've got tons and tons of stories with the recipe of things like Creole cream cheese on the end.
Yes.
So what about another story?
How about Leah Chase? Because we just adore Leah.
Well, Leah is my very best friend in the entire world. And there have been so many different stories told about Leah's experience during Hurricane Katrina, where her restaurant was destroyed. Virtually every one of her family members lost their homes. And Leah was just determined to get that restaurant back open again. And there's so many different stories, and there's so many different versions, but what I can tell you is that from December of 2005 through today, my husband, Nikki Molyneux, and I were very, very instrumental in helping Leah get that done, because it was amazing to me. There were people rallying around all sorts of different causes, and even this fried chicken joint that's a couple of blocks over from Leah's that in no way has the culinary heritage nor the racial uniting of people over food that has occurred before and after segregation that went on at Dookie Chase Restaurant. And so what you read in Louisiana Eats is the true story of what happened. And the book, it has stories. It has recipes. But David Spielman, who is an unbelievably talented New Orleans photographer, worked with me.
Those photographs are just absolutely amazing.
Yeah, amazing. There's no food photographs. This isn't a cookbook by any means. It's a people book. And so David took these photographs that, to me, are so special and so evocative. And Leah's photograph in particular is one of my very favorites.
I'm looking at it right now. Yeah.
What you see, what's going on in that picture, is that throughout the, Lord, it was almost 2 years before we got Dookie Chase open again. And Leah would just say to me, at that time, let's see, 8 years ago, Leah was 82 years old.
Wow.
And she was living in a FEMA trailer across the street from Dookie Chase Restaurant, trying to get that restaurant open. And she would say to me, Poppy, if I can just get this restaurant open again, I know my people will come back. And, of course, through the amazing rebuilding of New Orleans, the housing project that had been right across the street from Dookie Chase Restaurant was completely destroyed. It had been built in the 1940s in that typical, you know, huge housing project way. And it was rebuilt with more appropriate home-like spaces, duplexes, and it looks like a fabulous neighborhood, which is what it is. So that photograph is Leah looking out the window at that rebuilt neighborhood across the street from her restaurant with the knowledge that what she dreamed of has happened. And to me, it's like you see her taking a little glimpse of paradise.
Oh, yes. Oh, I talked to her when she was at the Beard Awards the year that they celebrated New Orleans.
Yes.
And she was not yet open, but she was determined.
It was 2006. She didn't open for another 2 years.
No, I know, but she was sure about it. I mean, she was positive.
What happened, if I can have the opportunity to say something, what happened then is we interviewed Frank Brightson and Leah Chase together. And we asked them, what can people do for New Orleans? And they said, come on back. We're open for business. Come on back.
Yeah, it's amazing how long people thought we were still underwater.
The wonderful thing about it, and I'm sure you'd agree, because we've heard it from John Bash, we've heard it from lots of other people, New Orleans is back.
It's back, and it's better than ever.
Right, right. So I think that's wonderful. If people are interested in inside scoop on what it is that makes New Orleans what it is, it's not the gumbo, it's not the Creole, it's not the this, that, and the other. It's the people behind it, as you said earlier in our discussion.
Yes.
Well, as I said, I mean, if people want these individual characters, now, I thought I knew a lot of them until there's some in this book that I had never heard of whatsoever. And so I really enjoyed learning about them. I didn't know Vance Vaucresson.
The Sausage Man, and you know, Vance Vaucresson, it's hilarious because he sings backup for John Boutte, the famous singer who is his cousin, as he says.
Yeah.
And his sausage is one of the vital ingredients in Leah Chase's Creole gumbo. There are several of the stories in Louisiana Eats that pursue one of my favorite topics that I like to cover a lot myself on my show Louisiana Eats, which is food and race. America has lived through such an interesting time. We are still in such an interesting time. And I worry that young generations now and to come may not really understand the struggle and the effort it took to end racial segregation in America, and in particular in eating places. A lot of people don't know that back in the time of segregation, it was just as illegal for white people to eat in black restaurants as it was for black people to eat in white restaurants. And there are at least three or four chapters that dwell from different angles on that topic of food and race.
Yeah, I do understand that, and I think that it's wonderful that you have a book that could be read on so many different levels, including some really serious issues such as the race issue and also the ARC and the whole slow food movement, and we haven't even got into the edible schoolyard, but there's so much on so many levels in your book. Honestly, Poppy, I'm just delighted to be able to talk with you about it, and I think everybody should read it.
Well, thank you, Anne. I'm as tickled as can be to have this chance to speak with you two on the radio today.
And we're going to talk even more, and we're going to come. We haven't been to New Orleans for about 2 years. So
well, you'll come back, and we will have a big time.
We will. Okay, Poppy, any other last words you want to say here?
Well, my great rallying cry is eat it to save it.
Yes.
And no matter if it's a heritage breed animal or an heirloom fruit or vegetable or Creole cream cheese, if we don't eat it, how in the world are we going to save it? So eat it to save it. My new motto, let's eat.
Thank you so much, Poppy.
Thank you so much. We'll talk again soon.
I hope.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Well, after all that, we're going to be Crescent City bound pretty soon, I think, my dear.
Yeah, I guess so.
We're sort of overdue, and it always makes me hungry when we do these programs with these wonderful chefs from way down south in Louisiana and New Orleans in particular. So anyway, we hope you'll join us again, same time, same place next week, because we'll be back, and we hope you will be too.
Bye-bye.